Lady Limerick, Reel 4.
During training, you earned about 8 pounds a week a year, you said.
As VADs, we got £20 a year.
What did that have to pay for?
Our uniform. Well, everything. I mean,
your food?
No. We were given board and lodging in the hospital, but the £20 was pocket money, as you might say. But you had to get your uniform out of that. And of course, in those days, we had these starched aprons and collars and cuffs and Sister Dora caps and what have you. And that was all quite expensive to get.
And would you have to pay for your own laundry?
No, that was down at the hospital. We got that free when we were resident in the hospital.
How many uniforms did you have?
Well, I suppose we had about four or five of those long blue dresses which came down to our ankles. And then we would have at least 14 aprons. And I suppose about half a dozen caps and those belts and collars. Stiff collars and things. All those awful studs that went flying all over the place. Couldn't be more uncomfortable, those uniforms, really. So stupid, weren't they, to go on with them.
Did anybody try to alter her uniform to make it more suitable?
We used to shorten our skirts, I think, and aprons and things like that until the matron caught us and then made me let them down again. But I don't think there was ever time to do anything like that. I don't think one fussed about uniform really very much or appearance.
What sort of living quarters did you have?
We were living in the same sort of huts as the patients, and we each had a small cubicle. And of course, none of them were heated, bitterly cold. I remember we had a washstand and basin and jug, and in the winter the water was always frozen right over the jug. And we had a mess room when we had our meals, part of the hut. We had tiny little cubicles, quite big enough, just for a bed and a dressing table and a washstand. But we didn't have dormitories, which I was grateful for.
Was it difficult for young women from good backgrounds to get used to living together with other people, washing, eating, sleeping?
Well, I think it probably depended if you'd ever been to school or not. If you'd been to a boarding school, there was no problem at all. I dare say it probably was, and that's where I think these older married women are so wonderful. They must have been anathema to them, I should have thought. But they didn't grumble or seem to mind it at all. I must say, looking back on it all, I do take off my hat to them. The young ones, it's almost freedom, you see, going from school, even to those sort of conditions. But they all seem to jog along quite happily together.
Just briefly, what would be a daily routine that you would have followed?
Well, if you were on day duty, you'd have your breakfast at 7 or half past 7, whatever it was. You'd come on duty at 8, and you'd have to do all the temperatures and dressings to start off with. And then you'd have to clean all the instruments afterwards and the trolleys and get them all ready for the next lot of dressings. If it was a very busy ward and the night nurse hadn't got time to do it, you'd have to do the washings too. Normally the night nurse did that, got the patients washed before the day staff came on. Then you'd have again 4 hourly dressings and temperatures and things like that, and then there'd be the men's dinners, and then after that there'd be, you could do a lot of the ward work too, cleaning the ward. They did have men orderlies too, but they really did absolutely nothing except carry the coal, as far as I can remember. We had stoves in the wards. And when we had several typhoid cases suddenly came in, so we all had to be inoculated. And the men all went down like ninepins, one after the other, and were given 48 hours sick leave. And the VADs were never expected to go down. I don't think they did, but had to do not only their own duty with their swollen arms, but all the orderlies' duties too, while the orderlies sat back, lay back on their beds, waited on by the VADs, which must be very unfair. Well, then in the afternoon there would be special duties. I mean, some days you'd have to clean the lockers, and other days you'd have to polish the floor or do quite a lot of these jobs too. And then again, we had the men's teas, and then in the evening there'd be all the dressings and temperatures and washing and that sort of thing too, before the night staff came on at 8, and then suppers before they came on. So we never stopped for one single instant. And on night duty, of course, you had all the medicines at 4 hours and dressings and things like that, and then you were supposed to get the men washed before the day staff came on. So it was a constant rush.
Would night be a more difficult time for seriously ill men?
Much more difficult. Yes, the worst time always is about 3 o'clock in the morning, when I think your physique is at its lowest. Mm-hmm. I think that's a generally accepted fact. And the ones who were really ill were always down the very worst time. And of course they weren't given sleeping pills in those days. I don't think anybody had a sleeping pill. They were given morphia. We were allowed to give them morphia when they were really bad. But apart from that...
Through an injection?
I don't think they were ever given sleeping pills.
A cup of Horlicks for sleeping pills?
That's the sort of thing. Oh, of course, they'd like a glass of beer or a bottle of whiskey, but that wasn't allowed. That was the only thing. Cups of tea, they always loved to have tea at all hours of day and night. And a good talk, I think that was the thing they enjoyed more than anything else, distracted them, took their minds off. And we had... a desk in the middle of the wall, the screen round, but somewhere where you could see all the way down the board, all the sides, so that you knew exactly what was going on. If somebody suddenly had a hemorrhage or something like that, you would see it at once.
Would they tend to help each other if one of them
oh, yes,
was having difficulties?
Oh, yes, frightfully good. Awfully good. Oh, it was absolutely splendid. And they were awfully cheering. Oh, good. Oh, see, that cheering took a different form, perhaps, as one would expect. I mean, all the great joke was whenever it was taken off on a stretcher to go to the theatre for an operation, you know, what flowers would you like, Bill? You know? That was the sort of form of cheering it took, but that was the sort of jolly way of saying, well, we'll be thinking of you. But they were awfully good to each other. Always help if they could. And awfully good to the nurses, would always give a hand if they possibly could. And we'll always take the side of the VADs against them. Poor downtrodden VADs, and the other being slanged at by the sisters, and we'll always be sympathetic and try and take their sides.
So you were there for about a year, did you say?
I was there for just over a year, yes. Mm. And then I went down to France.
So
yes.
You came back again when your father was ill.
That's right. Then I was only working in... going by the day to either this place in Grosvenor Crescent or Lady Evelyn Mason's hospital in Bruton Street.
And what did you do?
Same sort of thing. Same sort of thing. They were more or less all convalescents here, so that it was much more a question of taking them out and offer things on Sundays and Good Fridays and things. You take them to church and count their heads to see they hadn't gone out of the pub and they were going to church. They usually had. I had such a funny experience because I had a very absolutely splendid chap. He was a trooper in the lifeguards, I remember. And he was awfully nice, but a very weak sort of creature. And he was always having a little drop more than was good for him. And on one occasion, he had had more than was good for him. And he had acquired a puppy in the course of his outing. And when he came back, he was told that he was going to be sacked from the convalescent home and sent back to the depot in Liverpool, which was where he came from, which is an awful thing, one thing they all dreaded. But anyhow, nothing could be done about it. But what to do about this puppy? So he was in my ward, so he said, I suppose you wouldn't have it, nurse. So I said, well, I suppose I would if we've got nowhere else for it to go. And I took it back. The man was called Damson. We called this thing Dams. And it was the most enchanting puppy. And I had it for years and years, and of course he never came back again. I had it for years and years and years and years. But just after I acquired it, it had been in the habit of going round. He'd had it some time, I may say. It wasn't just that day that we... And he'd kept it very quietly where nobody could see it, so that he'd had it really in the hospital. I knew it was there, but it wasn't supposed to be there. And he'd taken it out for walks always when he went. And of course always ended up pub crawl, and I had the greatest trouble with this puppy when I first had it, because he used to rush into every pub. I suppose the smell of the pub was sort of familiar to it. And I used to have to pursue it in my Red Cross uniform, in and out of pubs all over the place. And finally I broke it of this habit, and it was quite good. But then I was in a car one day, and there was a car had a slight difference of opinion with a lamppost or something. I thought I'd broken into this habit, but we had this slight contretemps with the lamppost, because the car came to a grinding halt, and the door was flung open, burst open, and nobody was hurt or anything, but suddenly I realised the dog wasn't there. And then I looked over the road, there was a pub, and sure enough, believe it or not, it bolted straight into this pub, terrified, it leapt out of the car, and I suppose smelled the pub and gone straight in.
In its hour of stress.
Yes, yes. Extraordinary, isn't it? I could tell him, the poor dog.
What were you doing when the war ended?
I was in London then, working in hospital, and we had a great celebration, of course, and we all rushed down to Buckingham Palace and Jed and everything you can think of. Everyone had a slap up dinner at the Ritz and one of my boyfriends. And went on and working in hospital for quite a time afterwards. And then when I still went on, when I'd ceased working in hospital, there was no more need there, these hospitals, as Vera hospitals closed down, we ran through the Red Cross and St. John's a department for giving grants to disabled ex-service men pending their pensions and so on. One had to go into all the details of... forgive me one moment. Except trivialities, I've seemed to have talked about. Complete trivialities of all sorts and kinds.
Is there anything else that you think you ought to mention?
I shall think of it the moment you've left the room.
I'm sorry, which school?
I was at North Foreland Lodge. It was a school on the coast, quite close to Broadstairs. And because it was obviously in rather a vulnerable position, we were evacuated from there quite soon after the war to Malvern. Naturally, it was great excitement when we were down there because we have heard guns in the distance, and once, on one great occasion, a mine was washed up on the shore and we all rushed down to look at it. But we never got very near to the war there.
Were there any Zeppelin raids while you were at school?
No, not while I was at school. There were when I was at home afterwards, the one in Hertfordshire, I remembered, particularly. And there were one or two over London when I was back again from working in abroad, but I never had one, heard one close by. Had to wait for that for the Second World War.
And they weren't Zeppelins,
are they? No. Much worse than that.
When you left school, you opted for nursing. What would the other possible opportunities have been?
Well, one could have gone into munitions, I suppose, and worked in a factory. Of course, there was no conscripting of women in those days. And later on, one could have gone into, one of the women's services which started, but they didn't start right at the beginning of the war, if I remember rightly.
Yes.
Nursing was the rather obvious thing to do, or else to work in a munition factory. But you could choose what you wanted, because, as I say, there was no conscription. You weren't directed to anything in those days.
Did you know young women who were working in munitions?
Oh, yes. A friend of mine was working in a munition factory, and I always remember her telling me that... she couldn't get accustomed for a long time to the noise, and eventually somebody came along to her, rattled a tin in front of her face and said, would she give something to it? And she said, what's it for? And the reply was, for the young lady who lost her arm in your machine last week. So she said she subscribed liberally to it and hoped her successor would do the same. I've never had any mechanical mind at all, so I didn't... attracted me in the least.
At one point last time you said that someone said to you that VADs were the lowest order of worm. Who was it that called VADs in that sort of way?
Well, it was a fellow VAD at the hospital I was working at, Princess Christian's Hospital, Military Hospital, at Englefield Green. And when I asked her what the form was, how VADs were regarded, she said, oh, here we're regarded as the lowest order of worm the Almighty ever created.
Was that true?
Up to a point it was. at the early stages, I think it was, perhaps understandably, they thought we were a lot of silly young amateurs who were coming in and with ideas that we were going to give cooling drinks to seriously wounded patients and cool their brows with eau de cologne or something. But I think they soon lost that impression when they realized that we were out to do a job of work and we were prepared to work as hard as was necessary and to learn in the process.